somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone. Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us tonight. Welcome to Real Recovery. So glad you joined us. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio across the way. George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Phil.
And, of course, on the board is Alex. Hello, Alex.
Hello.
And Elena's in the phone room, which will probably be a long night for her, but we're glad she's here.
She's busy,
that's
I'm sure.
The team for tonight. George, I just want to let our listeners know tonight, you can trust God with the experience you're having right now. You can trust him
like
with the
that.
Experience you're having right now. God has no worries about how he's going to produce glory in your life. And if you have a lot of pain right now and you're scared and you're a little panicked and you've got suffering going on, our guest is going to give us some bright light on that subject because he's in the middle of quite a week. And he's made it to come to the studio tonight and share part of the story and share his life and his recovery. So we're excited to bring him on, time permitting.
Absolutely.
We might
if we can get to him.
If we get to him, we could be so interesting tonight, George, that we never get to him.
Or we could bring him on right now. You know, depends. Now, I'm really looking forward to it. Just met him tonight, Bill, and I know you know him, and what a great story. Great guy. So that's going to be exciting.
Yep. Now, George, when we talk about addiction, which is the subject of this show, I've been thinking about it this week, and it seems like there's either pain on the inside, there's pressure on the outside, or there's a pleasure-seeking principle in your life that has no dimmer switch. And those are kind of the three big ones that produce the greatest attraction towards substance addiction.
Well, it can work for everything, and that's why it becomes an addiction. It's our go-to vehicle, as we were talking about before we got on the air tonight, that it can cover us when we're sad, when we're happy, when we're lonely, when we're bored, and it works. And you know what, Bill? It works for a while. Our chemical of choice works for a while, and then the process starts where it doesn't work and we're trapped.
Mm-hmm. Jesus says that the truth will set you free, and he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So let's connect to the real source of power.
And I think if you finish that, it would say that no one comes to the Father except through the Son.
Mm-hmm.
And that ties into step five tonight, which we're going to talk about in a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And you can trust God through the power of the Holy Spirit to lead you and guide you into real, genuine truth. Jesus will be your protector and your provider and your healer from all the things that feel broken in your life right now. And that's why we're doing this show, George.
Because we're broken and God has delivered us.
And he's guiding us.
He is guiding us.
Yes, because we show up and we bring our best tone and tenacity to the show. You don't even
sometimes.
Know what that means. You don't
sometimes.
Know what that means.
Well, I had to think about if we bring our best. I try to tone it down.
What does that mean?
I try to, you know.
Why did you say it with that tone? Try to tone it down. What does that mean?
I said tone it down.
That's attitude.
I try to modify.
That's attitude.
I got a huge attitude. I'm kind of a punk. You know that.
Oh, you think?
I do know
yeah.
that. I think when the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth. And tonight it is on step five. And the truth that we have to share, Bill, is when we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, we want to make sure that God and ourselves are separate entities. Being our own God is what brought us into recovery. We want to make our own decisions all the time. And I've seen a lot of people work this step in 12-step groups and clients. And what we miss here is the confession piece to God. In 1 John 8:9, it says that if we are faithful to confess our sins, he is faithful to forgive us. And Jesus is the only one who can forgive your sins, so we want to get to heaven. It's appointed once to man to die and then the judgment, and we need to have our sins washed away. So you can do step five and feel really good about yourself after to get rid of the guilt and really come away floating and get that treatment high, and that's all good and great. But unless you have a relationship with the Son of God, you're not going to go to heaven. And, Bill, that's what differentiates the highest power from a higher power. One of our big tragedies, I think, in the recovery movement is God as you understand him has become God as you create him. And creating our own gods is what brings us into recovery in the first place. God as you understand him came from the Oxford movement, and what it really meant was how far you were along in your relationship with Jesus Christ. Your higher power is not the group, it's not the program, it's not the book, it's God. And God's existence does not depend on whether or not you believe in him. Your existence depends on that God created you, and there's a huge difference. And when we get into this step, Bill, you've got to be humble. You have to be honest and you have to be willing. This is tough, but it's not about feeling good so we can go on with the rest of our lives. It's to confess our sins to an all-holy God so we get forgiveness.
Excellent, George. Now, George, let's do a little diagnostic tonight because I've been working on this a little bit.
On you?
No, not on me.
Okay, because I'd be ready.
Seriously.
If there's an anger issue over there.
It's called microaggression.
Microaggression. You got it,
I'm feeling it right now.
Okay, I interrupted you, and please forgive me, sir.
All right, let's just say if you're listening tonight, maybe you are struggling with a compulsive I can't stop habit. Okay? That might be an obvious thing, right?
Yes, sir.
And that the lights on your scoreboard just went off because, okay, he's talking about me. All right, what about if you have something from your past family of origin that you're still struggling with as an adult, and that's still eating away at you? Let's say maybe you just have a very low self-image, and that's eating away at you, and that you've got the notion that your happiness is going to depend on how another person responds to you. So you're living with a whole mixture of feelings that are just tormenting you. And then you want to change the way you feel. Now, if I'm speaking to you, know that Christianity and following Christ is not about how you feel. It's about what you know. It's about what the Bible teaches is truth. And that truth gets into our heads and into our hearts, and it changes the way we think. And that should, in fact, change the way we feel. George, any thoughts on that? Because I worked on that all week.
Well, it's very deep, surprisingly, from where it came from. And I think it is well thought out, and I enjoyed it. But I would look at it to simplify it in that I think it's a lot easier to act ourselves into right thinking and feeling than to think ourselves into right acting. And what I mean by that is acknowledge those feelings and take them to the Lord, because we get to step one where we admit we're powerless. Maybe it's over people. Maybe it's over events. I think it's going to be over everything. And we have an all-sovereign God, Bill, that is in control. And if we pray to him, the prayer of a righteous man availeth much. That's in James. We can be on our way. Prayer and then action.
All right. So what about if people are constantly looking for and searching for something that's lacking or missing in their life?
Well, we are. Everybody is.
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it, Einstein.
You said if.
I did?
I believe so. You started it with a preposition, a sentence? Yeah.
Yeah, like I paid attention in English class. I don't use no double negatives.
You're right, you don't.
So what about the missing piece is obviously the God in your life. And if you don't have that in your heart, and if it doesn't speak truth to your life, you're going to be looking for plan B.
Yes, and nothing's going to be good enough, because those are all God substitutes, right? So if we're trying to fill ourselves out and up with anything other than Jesus, it might work for a while, but ultimately it's going to fail. And that failure is a good thing because it points us to the cross. I don't think anybody comes into recovery or anybody comes into their walk because they're flying first class and they're on a winning streak. There's going to be some hole there, some hurt, some disappointment that drives you, that you go, there's something more. Mm-hmm. And I think those things are good. And if it's a sovereign God, which it is, that he allows that, we should rejoice. It says that in James too. You know, rejoice in all your sufferings because it produces good things.
So, George,
I don't like to go through it myself, but I'm just talking about other people that should rejoice. I hate that.
Right. So maybe you're also suffering a little bit with denial, and maybe you're a master of it, and you're unable to recognize reality because you're so busy constantly trying to lie and cover up your life of deception. So you don't even know what reality is anymore. I mean, aren't addicts masters of denial?
Well, I think everyone is.
Well, I think, yeah, that's how we're born in a broken sin condition. And unless you have a changed heart and a regenerated spirit through a born-again experience, I think you're going to still be battling that nature.
Absolutely. I think one of the worst things, Bill, that can happen is to have total success without the Lord, because you think you're on your way and it's good. We see things, then we're probably going to hear some things tonight that seem like just an incredible tragedy, and people look back on their lives and go, God allowed that to happen for good. We know that in the story of Joseph, that Joseph said to his brothers, what man meant for evil, God allowed for good. And I don't know of anyone who comes into recovery where it was great, and they just said one day, I'm going to go to Jesus because this drinking's going so well. So I think that all does fit together.
Mm-hmm. And then, George, what happens when someone is willing to give up just about anything to satisfy their addiction? They're totally unable to stop their habit, and they even though they cry out and they want to stop, what's going on there?
Well, that is addiction. That my best efforts, I can't do anything, and sometimes I don't even want to quit. That is total brokenness. It's separation from God. And there's a physical death, but there's a spiritual death that can precede it a lot, and you can still be living, but you're a dead man walking. And mm-hmm. if you don't have Jesus, you are a dead man walking. But what can happen, Bill, is that can be changed instantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you have had a break in one of your relationships as a result of your addiction, you know, Jesus says we're supposed to love one another, and maybe you're in a fractured condition right now. We get that, and God will heal what's inside of you and what's between you and the other person. So hang on tonight and stay encouraged. God's got you right where he wants you, even though you might feel a little panicked tonight. We're going to have a very powerful testimony coming up with our in-studio guest in just a minute. You're listening to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. We will be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. I'm so glad you joined us tonight. Bill, George, Alex, we've got Elena in the phone room. We don't know if we're going to open the phone lines up tonight or not, George. If you have a question or comment for us, we will probably be stumped by whatever question you would call us with, but you're certainly welcome to give us a try at 1-877-933-2484. If a call comes in, I'm going to make George take it, so, you know. There's the pressure, George.
I think you read it fast enough that nobody could jot that number down, so I think we're safe, and I think we just move right along.
1-877-93-FAITH, which is also 1-877-933-2484. And if that's you want to give us a call, give us a call.
It's 675-309.
That's so stupid.
I know, but that's the only phone number I can ever remember.
Yeah. At times I think you're helpful, and other times I don't.
Thank you.
Yeah. George, our in-studio guest is Will, and Will's got quite a story to tell. I met Will about 30-plus years ago, and I was amazed at his level of vulnerability and honesty at a time when I was like, wow, who talks that way? So it left an impression on me. We were in a Bible study together, and then he had quite a life of using, and then it caused a lot of trouble in his life, and now he's in a much different place. Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So I, from what I understand, things were a little bit dicey at home. I mean, mom and dad were a little bit a certain way, and caused you a little anxiety. And
well, sure. And thanks for you guys for having me on. I've never done this before. I've never been on the radio, so this.
Well, welcome.
This is a new experience for me. But I grew up in a lower middle class family. My father was a blue-collar worker. In fact, he worked on the railroad. Mother was a stay-at-home mom. I'll get that.
That's good. You're
Thank
good.
You. I always, I don't know, growing up, I always felt like I was meant to get in trouble. I always felt sort of on the outside. Made a lot of stupid decisions, was getting in trouble a lot, and just always feeling different than those around me. That was sort of life starting out for me. You know, I sort of found my way the best way I could. My father worked a lot of hours, so he wasn't that prominent in my life at that time. So I found ways to get by. And I was in a neighborhood that there wasn't a whole lot going on. There wasn't a whole lot available to me in the way of resources and whatnot. So I just found my way, and a lot of times it meant getting into scraps that, I wouldn't have otherwise found. So, that's, as a kid, that's how I started out.
And how old were you when you first had a little sampling of drugs or alcohol?
12. I was 12 years old.
George, we keep hearing that. That's a super young age to be dabbling.
Yeah, I think it's about right. Well, first thing, a cigarette?
Well, yes. I used to steal my dad's Lucky Strikes off of his dresser, sneak into his bedroom and take those and take them to school.
Oh, those were good. The no filter
ones. Oh, absolutely. It was the way to go.
Sorry, Bill.
Straights. Yep.
Yeah.
But I have an 11-year-old cousin who lived in Illinois who was the one that turned me on to drugs. And that was at, I was 12 years old.
What did you try at 12?
At 12, I did marijuana, smoked some opium, smoked some angel dust.
Mm.
So, I mean, it was right out of the gates. And as soon as I figured out what these did to me, I realized quickly what they could do for me.
Mm. I don't know if I know what that means.
Okay, well, let me expand on what that means. I was restless as a kid. I was, looking back, I was probably very depressed as a kid. Although in those days, they didn't recognize childhood depression. All I knew was that I never felt right in my own skin.
So pain was on the inside.
Oh, it was, yeah. Yep. And I was always fearful of so many things. I was fearful of people. I was fearful of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Fearful of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I quickly discovered when I had these drugs in my system that I felt like somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And the pain went away.
Mm-hmm.
So it was some real exposure early on. So
12, then now you're how old? You 15, 17, and have you progressively using harder drugs?
Well,
I mean, opium and angel dust is about as hard as you get.
Yeah, but those were, you know, I was just sort of sampling. This was like the sample stuff they had.
Okay.
When I came back to the Twin Cities, then I just found, you know, I was looking around to find just marijuana. But I was, you know, quickly I was using it on my own. I wasn't using it socially. I was using it on my own, almost medicinally. So, you know, drugs and alcohol never represented social lubricant for me. It was always medicinal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, sure, and now I'm smoking every day.
What are you, 17?
Well, not even 17 quite yet.
Okay.
This was all through from, say, 12 to 17.
Okay.
Yeah.
Every day.
Well, for the most part, if I could afford it.
Okay.
Still hadn't found alcohol yet, but this was going on, and I was, you know, my grades were fine, but what it meant was I went away from Duke because I was involved with sports. In school, I wrestled and I ran track and I played little league ball. In fact, I played baseball with Joe Maurer's dad, Jake
mm-hmm.
Maurer. He was in the same league as I was, so I was active in sports. When I started using, that all fell off.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, quickly I started running with a new crowd. I finished school, went on, but so there I was off to the races.
When did you bring alcohol into the equation?
Well, so I call myself a late bloomer with alcohol. I didn't start really drinking until I was about 17. But after I took that first drink, I was done for. I knew that I drank alcoholically from the day I picked up.
Now, was that for social lubrication or was that for
medicinal?
Well,
that was under the guise of being social.
Okay.
You know, it allowed me to, at the age I started drinking, the drinking age was 18. Well, I was 17, but I had found a way to get a fake ID and I was getting into bars.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Should do a background check on these guys, Bill.
Yeah.
A fake ID?
Yeah.
And so quickly I found that I could be part of a social scene, that I could meet girls, I could have the confidence to talk to them, that I could you know, that anxiety wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
When I was drinking.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, were you 18 and still in high school, or had you graduated?
No, I had graduated when I was 17.
Okay, because you remember back then when I was 18, what a dangerous combination to be 18, able to write your own notes, and buy liquor your senior year in high school. Yeah. Just insanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always wondered why.
One of the best years of my life, but it was insane. You know, you think because we were all messing up.
But you were 23 when you were still in high school, George.
Well, you didn't have to bring that up. I was an academic redshirt.
He was set back a couple of grades.
Yeah, I was, yeah. Thanks for bringing that up.
No problem.
Let's get back to our guest, yeah. So,
and I always thought that. I always thought, you know, why am I allowed to be in these bars? I mean, it just never lined up with me. I wasn't about to argue with it because now when I turned 18, I could drink legally. But I always found that to be, this just didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm. It's not right, I don't think, Farrah.
Yeah.
So this is progressing, and this is kind of your life, isn't it?
Already.
Yeah.
Yeah, already.
What did you do when you got out of high school?
Well, I started working. My father went on from the railroad to do a part-time sales and eventually managing the showroom for a small mom-and-pop furniture store on Lower East Hennepin in Minneapolis. And so he starts wearing suits. You know, it's kind of cool to see him come home and be wearing suits and having a little bit more money, because we didn't have any money. We didn't. I remember having to buy my first bicycle. I mean, having saved my own money up, and that's just the way it was. I mean, I never thought anything of that. But so I ended up getting into, quite by happenstance, into the furniture business, not with him, but in a different place. And so, you know, my idea was to go back to school, but here now I'm starting to feel that with the help of drugs and alcohol, I can be social and be in a kind of a social career. And so I went into retail sales and did that for quite a few years. But all the while, my drinking is increasing.
Now, is there any spiritual side to your life? Are you a church guy?
Good question. My parents were what I would term as sort of drive-through Christians.
Okay.
They would drop me off at the curb at church and made sure that, and you know, and I thank them for this.
Would they come to a complete stop?
Sometimes not, depending if they were late. They kind of kick me out the side. Mm-hmm. They would.
Hit and roll, though.
That's right.
The key is the hit
that's
and roll.
Right. And so, actually, as a kid, I was going to a Lutheran, small Lutheran church. I was involved in the youth group. In fact, I remember one night we were painting the youth group, painting the walls that needed some refurbishing. And me and my buddy actually broke into the church one night to do some of this work because we were so into it. So I had this understanding of who God was. In fact, at that time, the popular album was Jesus Christ Superstar, and we would play that over and over again. And I learned more about who Christ was through that album, which was written by a couple of atheists.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a guy give a talk. It wasn't a very good talk about a week ago, and the speaker talked about that.
Did he?
Yeah. Wasn't a very good talk, but I found that was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the little digs that George does. He thinks he's so funny. It was actually me he's talking about. But, you know, it's the scene
where
yeah, it was me.
Okay, sorry.
It was me. But it's the scene where Herod's, you know, looking at Jesus saying, so this is Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. You look so small, not a king at all.
Right.
And it's like, you know, we're he comes as a, you know, he took our sins on the cross.
I like that. That's a great reference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Do you take me for a fool, walk across my swimming pool? Isn't it that one?
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, lots more with Will. Thanks for being with us tonight. You're listening to Real Recovery. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery, Georgie. Let's talk about addiction here, okay?
Okay.
We talk about positive things. We talk positive, right?
Yeah.
Let's get the, I guess, back on the show.
I'm very agreeable when I hear that accent, you know. I just want to roll with it. What well, it reminds about? Me of a long time ago. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I said you go ahead.
Oh, so we're talking to Will tonight, and he is, has been kind of giving us a sketch of the using starting at 12, which was pot, and then it escalates into alcohol and various other experimental drugs. And then I think what we're moving into next is you've discovered something quite powerful, which is cocaine.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was all powerful because it kept me from who I was. It kept me from feeling my real thoughts. Because you know what? When I even today, when I want get a craving to use, what I have to look at is that I don't like the way I feel, and that's what my draw is. So I mean, living a life of not liking the way that I was feeling so far, it was natural for me to sort of progress into this other stuff. And frankly, for me, it was just whatever's in front of me. I did when I was 25 years old. I started having some panic attacks, and it was what I used to refer to as these unknown fears, of this fear, this dread that would come over me out of nowhere for no good reason. And along about this time, I was approached by a couple of I have two sisters, and they approached me about getting an evaluation that they were starting to worry about my drinking. So I went down to a local place and had a evaluation, and you know, without a doubt, I think I rang up, you know, 12 out of possible 13 answers, and you know, two was the cutoff. Okay, so it was clear. Yet I wasn't really ready to do anything about it. So I took that information, hung on to it for about a year, and then finally I ended up going through an outpatient program. And
So you didn't rush right in there? You waited a couple of years. You wanted to process it, huh?
You know why? Because I had this idea of what it was to be an alcoholic, this stigma that was attached to, you know, I can't be that. I'm 25 years old. Are you kidding?
Now, were you using every day or were you a bencher?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I drank from the day I picked up my first drink till my last one today, you know, so far. I drank alcoholically every night for the next 20 years. I can count on one hand the number of days I didn't drink.
Wow.
And I always drank to get drunk. There was no reason not to.
Blackouts?
Well, eventually blackouts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by a blackout is I would completely forget everything that went on the night before. I would sometimes black out in the middle of doing it. I would black out and then come to, and I'm still under the influence. I'm still drunk. Mm. But I don't remember what's just happened.
Okay.
Very frightening stuff. And so I ended up, So I ended up, you know, at 25, I do this eval. 26, I go to treatment. I start going to some recovery meetings. And so, you know, I'm not drinking and I'm not really doing anything else. However, you know, after all, I went into those for alcohol, not anything else. And so that's okay for me then to get introduced to cocaine, which I did.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, oh, I can do this because, you know, after all, alcohol is my problem. So I start using cocaine recreationally with a friend. And just to not belabor this time period too long, eventually I'm well off to the races with my cocaine use. And to show you how much denial there is in this, I kid you not, I would show up to a recovery meeting for alcohol. I'd be sitting in the parking lot waiting for the meeting to start, and I'd be snorting lines off of the dashboard of my car. That's how much in denial I was about my chemical use. Eventually, I learned how to cook cocaine, and I started smoking it. In those days, it was referred to as freebase, which in no time started to take me down and take me down hard. The only way to support my habit was to start to deal cocaine. I started to make connections with people in the field. Of course, doing so, my consumption ramped up even more, and now I had about a $400 to $500 a day habit.
So your whole life is getting it, using it, getting some
absolutely.
More. Okay.
Absolutely. Just to talk a little bit about those days, got in with the wrong people, as one can imagine. There was a deal that went wrong that was not of my doing, but all indications pointed toward me. These people were after me with semi-automatic weapons. I had to flee town. I actually faked my own death to get them off my back.
Who hasn't done that, though?
You can pull the drapes down over there, Bill.
Don't worry. That's bulletproof glass.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay. Sorry, I didn't say that. Yeah.
No, we had a...
That's a little insanity, isn't it?
It is very insane. But they were relentless, and they knew where I was.
I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about you. Yeah.
Oh.
You're off the rails.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much off the rails.
That qualifies at step one, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I appreciate you sharing that, because it goes quick, doesn't it?
Oh, man.
And all of a sudden, you're in Nutland. You know, we're doing stuff that we would never conceive of doing, and seems normal,
doesn't it? If you would have told me that I would be in a position where I'm hole up in my apartment for days on end, living like a mole, answering, people had to come to my door, and they, each one had a code that they could knock on the wall to indicate that it was them. So I knew it wasn't the feds or the cops or okay. somebody to rip me off. Living in complete paranoia with a $400 a day habit.
Mm. Yikes.
And now people after me. I had no choice but to flee. And the only thing that made sense was for me to go out to a residential treatment program about 100 miles out of town, which is what I did. So I hid out there, spent the next 6 months.
What happened when you got there? Were you ready to do the work?
I thought I was. Sure did.
Sounds like a no to me, George.
Well, I thought he was.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I'm 6 foot two. I was 140 pounds because I'd been doing so many drugs for so long. I get out there, you know, it's three hots in a cot, big, you know, really good starchy food.
Mm-hmm.
I quickly jumped from 140 to about 200 pounds in about the next 2 months. Okay. Feeling pretty good, doing the deal. They want me a year. That's how messed up I am. They want to keep me in treatment for a full year.
You negotiated that down,
didn't you? Of course
I did.
Okay, I came to them after about 6 months, and I just said,
good to go?
Good. You know what? I got everything I need here. Thanks a lot. You know, you guys have been great. I'm going to do this all by myself, you know, because I'd been productive. You know, I got there. I was making thousands of dollars a night selling drugs. Of course, never converted to cash because it's all product and I'm using it.
Mm-hmm.
And after a month of being in treatment, they allowed me to have a job where I could make 50 cents a day cleaning the cafeteria.
So you're not filing, you're filing the short form now, aren't you?
I sure am. But you know what? I'm happy as a pig in mud because I got a job and I'm feeling productive. I will never forget this. Feeling like a human being again with my little 50 cent a day job cleaning the cafeteria floors. And boy, they were messy because we shared with the CD people shared it with the mentally ill. They would all share the, you know, and these poor folks.
Sure.
They couldn't handle them. You know, they couldn't handle it. So it was a messy job, but I loved it. Because it meant being part of things again.
Didn't the thought occur to you, now that I'm not using, maybe I could sell that stuff and really make some money? Or were you healthy enough to not do that?
Oh, there's certainly a thought crossed my mind. But you know what? I adored cocaine. I adored it. I remember sitting one night with a pile of it on my coffee table thinking, and I said out loud, I said, God, forgive me because I love this stuff. It's everything to me.
I get that. And, you know, cocaine almost killed me, and someday it might if I get out of my walk.
Mm-hmm.
It's bigger. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's so seductive. It's evil. Cocaine is so seductive.
How did God overcome that in your life? Because what you described is just right on. It is.
Isn't it bigger? Yeah.
It's bigger.
So, you know, to fast forward, I came back into town, and, of course, after 6 months, I'm using the very night I hit the city limits.
Mm.
You know, all that stuff I learned, all the good feelings, all of that stuff out the window.
Mm.
I'm right back
Yikes.
In it. And you know why? Because nothing's changed.
Okay.
I didn't change a thing back at home.
Mm. It's powerful.
You know?
That's a lot of power. Here's a guy that put 6 months of his life in. He's doing some of the good work. He's doing
yep.
the deal. My guess, yep. you're working the steps,
yep.
talking the talk, goes back into the old environment, and bam,
boom.
Gone.
Nothing
mm-hmm.
changed.
Scary. So what happened next?
Well, so the next several years were horrendous. Things just got worse. It was a series of bottoms. And I'm getting more and more hopeless and more helpless. And I'm thinking there's no out. And so now I think, well, I remember those recovery meetings I went to. They were pretty good. Those folks seemed to have some answers. Let me go back and try them. And because now I'm wearing thin.
Mm-hmm.
I am wearing thin. My nerves are shot. I got everybody's thrown up their hands on me. My family and friends had done an intervention on me, which is why I went to treatment a second time, because it was the timing with this thing where the people were after me, blah, blah, blah. And but nobody, you know, they're tired of it. It's been this lip service all this time, and I'm not changing. In fact, mm-hmm. I'm getting worse, and they're scared for me. So I start going to these meetings, but every week I'm going and I'm coming clean. Every week I'm saying, guys, I did it again. I used this week. And they'd say, you know what, Will, we love you. Keep coming back. We're here for you. Okay? And this went on for a long, long time.
How was that for you?
Confusing. I was losing. I thought, this doesn't work for me. I'm the exception. This is the one. These meetings don't. They work for them, but they don't work for me. This business of being uniquely different than everyone else. But
did you
you
were constitutionally incapable? Did you think you were one of those guys?
No. You know what it was? I was guilty of magical thinking.
Okay.
My friend talks about this a lot, that the universal laws of the world don't apply to me. That I'm invincible. There's always a back door. As bad as I might be, I'm in such denial that it's never going to be that bad. I'm not going to die over this. I'm not going to, you know, it's. There's always an escape hatch.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, George, that is a good time to take a break. We're going to take one short break and come back. We've got another segment with Will, and we have got a couple of big pieces of news coming up in the next 15 minutes, so don't go anywhere unless you have to. Then that's okay, but I hope you don't. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill, George, Alex, and Elena is the big team tonight. We're talking to Will in studio, and Will is now taking us to the point in his journey where the running has to stop and Jesus is knocking on the door.
Okay. Well, as you can well imagine, you know, I've had it. But here's the trippy part about bottoms. They're so different for everyone. One would think that the amount of stuff I've been through, I mean, I lost everything. I had a condominium apartment that was the bank took. I was, for all intents and purposes, homeless. I had had people after me. My health was going. And yet, it wasn't enough. And I remember sitting, I used to meet this. So I managed to keep my relationships with some of these guys at the recovery meetings. And a group of them met every Monday night at this local restaurant. And when I was feeling good to reenter society, in other words, when I was coming out of a binge and feeling good enough to be in public with other people, I would show up to this thing. And this particular night, I showed up to the restaurant. And I got there early, and there was one guy there out of a group of eight guys. And I'm feeling, you know, I'm still drunk from the night before. And I had, in a blackout, called him and in 3 in the morning, and I'm going on about, you know, I'm just having some difficulty. And this is one of the guys who would say, hey, we love you, keep coming back again and again. Well, he wasn't saying this tonight. He's looking at me, and he's like, I've had it. And this is a guy, this is a fellow alcoholic, but he's had it. I mean, this is how far down the road I've gone, okay? So I'm sitting there, and he's kind of reading the paper or whatever. The other guys haven't funneled in yet, and I'm sitting there, and there's this moment where, you know, I'm thinking, so how bad does this have to get? And I'm looking for this bottom to occur, like this white light, this burning bush experience to happen. And instead, what I get saddled with is, Will, you're dying. And instead of being fearful of that, I was comforted by it. I was in such pain that the idea to lose my life was actually very comforting. No fear, nothing, just pure comfort. And in looking back to that, I realized that was a beginning of a surrender point for me. What God had saw fit to do was the next guy that walked in was a guy that used to sponsor me at these meetings. And he had just come from a seminar, Joe and Charlie, a couple of guys that do this thing on addiction. And he was like 3 feet off the floor. I mean, he had this sort of spiritual awakening. And so he's looking at me the whole time. All the guys funnel in, and I'm sitting there, and I just feel awful. The guy won't talk to me, and he's looking at me like he's just grinning at me like some moron, you know, at the table the whole time, not saying anything, just nodding at me, smiling lovingly. We go outside, and he says, come here a second. He said, I think I know what your problem is. And I said, oh, do you? I mean, please tell me. I mean, I didn't believe it for a second. He says, I think you're mistaking this obsession to keep using for the need to keep using. And he said, I'm here to tell you that you never have to live this way again as long as you live. And his words came out of his mouth toward me, and they had light around them. They just were glowing, and it was like a bullet. It was like a diamond bullet that just hit me right between the eyes. And I remember going home that night and getting on my knees and praying some kind of semblance of a prayer, but I don't remember what it was. And got up the next day. Almost forgot about that experience, but then at that point decided to get involved. I thought, hey, maybe I'll plan on going to a recovery meeting every night this week. So I did that. I set that up, but I'm expecting to relapse again because it's been my pattern. I managed to go 9 months clean and sober on every mood-altering chemical. But I'm restless, and I want more. Bill, you were talking earlier about wanting more, okay? And it was Easter morning in 1990, and a friend took me to a local church. And this church did altar calls. And so I'm there, you know, I'm just there because, oh, this is a great thing to do. Maybe I'll get some answers because I was cursing like a truck driver in these days. I thought, you know, I'm going to tighten up my language a little bit. He does this altar call, and I feel this energy coming from the altar up toward me. And suddenly, all these people are, like, turned my way. And it's supposed to be heads down. And it's me, and I'm looking around, it's like, okay. And I feel this moving inside me to go down to that altar. And I did. And there was people, in getting to know people later on, they report that they felt this rush of energy coming over them as they saw me go down. A total spiritual awakening for me. And I answered that altar call and had a born-again experience right there that morning on Easter morning, 1990.
Wow. Good day to have it.
Neat.
Yeah. So I'd already been on my way to recovery through the help of these recovery meetings, and I maintain those for the next. In fact, I, to this day, go to recovery meetings. Because left to my devices, nothing changes. Because I have to understand that I have to surrender to a power greater than me, and that's God and Jesus Christ. But it hasn't been a bed of roses recovery. It's been a lot of heartache, a lot of hurt. My mother, who had always struggled with depression, when I was 18 months sober, she took her own life. She lost the battle with her depression. I was mad at God for many years after that because I'd been praying for her, hands on. I'd been sharing the gospel with her, and I was very angry with God. And I fell away from the church. I was not taking part in my own relationship with God, because that's what this born-again experience had offered me, a personal relationship with God for the first time. Not the youth room back at the Lutheran church, but a personal relationship with God. Okay. I had a rough week this week. And was ready, and I had told Bill that I needed to reschedule because I had learned a week ago tonight that my brother, who lives in Colorado, was hit head-on by a drunk driver going 100 miles an hour in a 40-mile zone, and that he was in critical condition in a coma. His condition has not gotten any better throughout the week, and I contacted Bill yesterday, and I just said, Bill, I need to be there with you doing this because it's where I need to be. Because recovery doesn't mean that I'm able to stay clean and sober when life's going good. It means when life shows up on life's terms and it means problems, it means heartache, I still have to keep doing this, the things that I do. And what that means for me is sharing myself with others, as hard as that might be. I'm getting a lot of help. I don't do any of this alone. I've been on my knees a lot this week. I've asked others to intercede. In his name is Johnny, on his behalf for healing, or at very least what God's will is in this situation. I believe it's for healing. But I don't do this alone, and I don't think any of us do.
And, well, didn't he have his 7-year-old son in the car with him, and he's okay right now?
Yeah, Parker is 11 years old, and Parker usually likes to ride in the back seat of Dad's car, and instead he rode in the front seat, thank goodness, because this guy hit him so hard it split the car in half and sent the rear end several hundred yards into a nearby yard. And had Parker been sitting back there, he wouldn't be here today. Instead, he was in the hospital for a couple of days with a concussion and is now back home with Mom. My brother's still in critical condition a week later.
And he's unresponsive right now, still in
he's
coma.
He's not only not responding to commands, but his BP and temperature are going through the roof, and they're trying to manage his brain swelling.
So please pray for Johnny. It's such a heartbreaking story. It's so hopefully the power of the of prayer through the Faith Radio Family Network. They're faithful people that do things like offer prayers up for Johnny, and I appreciate doing that.
You know, I want to thank you for suiting up and showing up, helping my recovery tonight. And you're right, we show up. And your story is very valuable. We got to have you back because there's a lot we left out. But you're a great guy, and I appreciate you showing up tonight with the circumstances and sharing your story and sharing the reality of how the walk isn't always great.
It's difficult, and you went through a ton. And when you had a decision to follow Christ, boy, the Holy Spirit comes into your life and changes who you are and how you think. And so you've got a powerful set of truths living inside you now, and what a difference it's made. But my heart is heavy tonight for Johnny, and so yep. Let's just all remember him in your prayers tonight. And that is going to wrap up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. We'll hope to see you next week. Have a great week, everybody. Good night, and God bless.